Hi, everyone. I know you've been hearing me talk about how much I enjoy BritBox. It's the streaming home of the best British TV, with exclusive mysteries, crime dramas, documentaries, and more. I especially enjoy mysteries like Agatha Christie's Poirot and Father Brown. I just enjoyed his story, The Thief, His Wife, and the Canoe. Great story. My daughter has always been a huge Cary Grant fan, and BritBox has a new original called Archie, which stars Jason Isaacs as Archie Leach, the man who became Cary Grant. This is the first time that his story has been told in collaboration with Grant's daughter Jennifer Grant and his ex-wife Diane Cannon. Story and cast all from BritBox, and it's top-notch entertainment, and only on BritBox. Sign up for BritBox today to stream Archie and other fan favorites from any device. I have a special limited-time offer for my U.S. and Canadian fans. Get 50% off your first month when you sign up for a monthly plan, but only if you go to BritBox.com and use my promo code 1001STORIES at checkout. That's 1001STORIES at checkout. Don't wait. Get 50% off your first month. Use promo code 1001STORIES at BritBox.com. You'll be glad you did. Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries Podcast. This is your host, John Hagedorn. And today we have with us author Samuel W. Mitchum, Jr., who has written over 40 books and great books, a lot of good books on World War II. And today we're covering a brand new book of his called The Death of Hitler's War Machine, The Final Destruction of the Wehrmacht. Sam, it's great to have you with us today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I would like you, if you could, to share a little bit of your background with us, and then we'll go for it.
All right. I was born in Rouge, Louisiana. Went to Northeast Louisiana University and became an Army helicopter pilot at the end of the war and Vietnam. And then I stayed active in the reserves, but I decided on an academic career. And attended North Carolina State and University of Tennessee, and spent 20 years as a professor of geography and military history at Henderson State, Georgia Southern, and University of Louisiana at Monroe. Stayed active in the reserves. I'm a graduate of Command and General Staff College, which is a school for generals, and that was a tough school, but I enjoyed it. Married, two kids.
You've written over 40 books, many of which were about World War II. What made you decide to write The Death of Hitler's War Machine?
Well, I decided to do that years ago. I was in the National Archives looking for something very specific, and they sent me to an area they don't allow the general public in, and it was a big bay-type office. And there was a guy going frantically through the filing cabinets with his back to me. And I didn't really want to yell, "Hey, you." So I asked him, "Can't you find it?" And he was startled, but he said, "No, I can't." I asked him what he was looking for. And he said he wanted to find a copy of Hitler's Last Will and Testament. And I asked him, "Is that here?" And he said, "Well, we have a copy in this room, but we have an original in the vault, but nobody gets to see that." And his name was Georg Wegner, and we talked a while, and other people came in. We had a large bull session going, about 8-9 people, I guess. And he disappeared for a while and came back, and he had gone to the vault and checked out one of the four original copies of Adolf Hitler's Last Will and Testament. Every signatory was dead within 3 days. You know, had the Führer type. Adolf Hitler needed glasses, but he didn't want the German people to know it. So he had special typewriters made with large fonts so he could read it. Georg said, put your nose to the paper and smell it. So I did. And the odor of the Führer bunker had permeated that paper. And with my eyes closed, for just a second, I had the sensation that it was 1945 and I was in the Führer bunker. You could smell the smoke and the dankness and the darkness. And it was a surreal moment. And I looked up from the paper and said to Georg, "Wow." And he looked at me and said, "Exactly. That's funny." And I figured I wanted to get around to writing that book at some point. And I finally, now that I'm retired from academia, I did so. And it was fun. It was a good read. It was really not a good time to be alive if you were a German. But yep. I drew some conclusions. It's like there were two different wars going on, the war in the East and the war in the West. The war in the East was very brutal, and the German soldiers fought very hard. In the West, after the Battle of the Bulge, German morale collapsed. This was their last chance offensive. It was defeated, and they knew they were going to be beaten. And in the West, the German soldier had a reasonable expectation of coming out of it alive if he surrendered. The Americans probably weren't going to shoot him. He was going to be in prison maybe for a year or two. But he would eventually get back home. No such expectation existed in the East. Many Germans were executed. Gosh, a lot of Germans were kept in prison until 1955. The war ended in 45. And they would never have been released, I don't think, had it not been for their chancellor, Konrad Adenauer. They had negotiations, and I thought it was Adenauer's tough negotiator. But the deal was the United States would recognize East Germany, which desperately needed our foreign exchange, and Russia would recognize West Germany. And that was the basic agreement until about 3 days before. And Adenauer said, "Oh, by the way, if you don't return all our prisoners to Germany, the deal's off." Well, the Russians didn't like that one bit because that is pulling a new demand right out of thin air from their point of view. But Adenauer was, like I say, he's a great negotiator. They tell you in business, don't be afraid to walk away. He walked away, and the Russians capitulated, and that's when the last German soldiers came home. They would have been there till they died, I think, had it not been for Adenauer.
What were Hitler's chances prior to the Battle of the Bulge? How did it look?
Prior to the Battle of the Bulge, I think if the Germans had repulsed the Normandy invasion, a reasonable man could come up with a scenario where Nazi Germany, if it didn't win the war, could at least survive it. After Normandy, according to Field Marshal Model, who commanded Army Group B on the major army group on the Western Front, the chances were down to about 10%. And, of course, he launched the Battle of the Bulge. And after that, the 10% was gone. That was their last chance offensive. I wouldn't dispute the 10% figure Model gave. I think if best case scenario for Germany, if they'd captured Antwerp, they would have had a couple of Panzer armies freed, which they could use somewhere else. The war certainly would have lasted another year. But when the Bulge failed in the West, it was time to go home. And history bears that out. I mean, shortly thereafter, the bridge at Remagen was captured. And while that didn't have a great deal of military significance, it was psychologically devastating for the Germans because the Rhine line had been breached. There was no hope at that point. And the following month, we had the Battle of the Ruhr Pocket, which was one of the most lopsided victories in American military history. We captured over 300,000 Germans soldiers at a cost of 1,700 casualties. Military terms, that's lopsided. And it ripped a 200-mile hole in the German front. There was no way. They had nothing left to cover it with.
That's an undertold story, the Battle of the Ruhr Pocket. That's an undertold story, I think. Can you give a quick synopsis of that?
Well, yeah. We breached the Rhine in two major locations north of Remagen and encircled them with using three American armies. And we trapped the German 15th Army and the 5th Panzer Army in the Ruhr, which was a major German industrial area. And without the Ruhr, Germany could not wage war. We surrounded it, and that's when you began to have mass surrenders.
How many months after Market Garden was that?
8 months.
Okay, yep.
Yeah, Market Garden, of course, was a, it was doable, but the odds against it succeeding were small.
And it depended upon the progress and cooperation of both sides. And I think the Americans felt like they paid their dollar, but Britain fell short. I don't know if you agree with that assessment, and that's not the subject of your book, but we did a two-part episode on that. There was a lot of frustration.
Well, you know what they say. The only thing worse than fighting with allies is fighting without allies.
Yeah.
And I think that was true. Actually, it was a very bold move on the part of Montgomery, who's a man that you don't often associate with the word bold. But the problem was they expected an average reaction time from the Germans. And they did not realize that Field Marshal Model, commanding the major army group on the Western Front, had his headquarters 2 miles from the British drop zone.
Yep.
He didn't have to rely on reports from subordinate commanders. He looked out his window and saw them. The reaction time was incredibly rapid. The British just got unlucky. I mean, luck plays a part in war, and they just didn't have any at Arnhem.
There's been a lot of stories about the Battle of the Bulge, but your story right now is well-researched and covers a time period from the Battle of the Bulge till the actual fall of Hitler's regime, which makes it very, very interesting and compelling. Can you give us an overview of what happened during that time from the end of the Battle of the Bulge to the actual fall of the regime?
Well, we've kind of covered it on the Western Front. You had the bridge at Remagen, the Battle of the Ruhr Pocket, and the collapse of the German war machine in the West. In the East, it was quite different. Well, the Germans never had a chance at this point. In January 1945, they had 1.8 million soldiers on the Eastern Front. Stalin had 7 million. They were outnumbered in every conceivable military category, at least 5-1, well, except brains. They did have some great generals. The Russians, when they made their major breakthrough for miles and miles, had an artillery density of 420 guns per mile. It was tremendous bombardment. Stalin figured he would be in Berlin in 3 or 4 days once the offensive started. It took him over 2 weeks. They had my point about the good German generals, the commander of Army Group Wistow was a guy named Henrici. And he had what the Germans called a fingertip feel for the battle. And he had a reputation on the Eastern Front for always pulling out just before the major battle. And he would draw his front line a mile or two, and the major Russian artillery bombardment, which they depended, missed. It missed its target. Well, it happened again when Stalin launched his major offensive in the east, and Ricky had pulled out the night before. Artillery bombardment hit thin air, and then it was muddy. They had to go through their own shell craters, and many of their tanks got stuck in the mud. And the Germans went forward. They had this kind of resembles a log, except better. It was called the Panzerfaust, single-shot, shoulder-fired, disposable anti-tank weapon. And they knocked out a lot of Russian tanks. And Henrique did everything right, but he could not hold Berlin. And I don't think he meant to. He left four divisions in Berlin, but it was more a contested mop-up operation than it was a major battle. By then, the Germans were retreating. The Hitler played into their hands, too. He sent most of his panzers to Hungary, and they had a big battle over at Budapest in that area. But in the east, Army Group Vistula was supported by 6th Air Fleet. It only had 300 airplanes, and most of those weren't fighters. Russians committed 10,000 airplanes to the battle. He never had a chance in the long run, and he knew it. And once it became convenient, he abandoned Berlin. He knew it was over.
You utilized rarely seen before German wartime documents to help you write The Death of Hitler's War Machine. What was the most surprising thing that you discovered in your research?
Oh, I suppose it would have been the naval evacuation. They evacuated East Prussia and Pomerania by sea. I guess I should start that out by saying this is pretty good proof that terrorism is often counterproductive, because the Russians were allowing their men to rape, pillage, murder. There was no punishment for this. Matter of fact, their propaganda encouraged it. And it created a mass evacuation situation. But also the Fieldgau, the German equivalent of the GI or the British Tommy, fought like the Dickens, because he wanted to protect his home, his family, his country. And he knew that he likely wouldn't survive. And he had nothing to lose. And people who don't have anything to lose are dangerous. I talk about in my book about General Nering. He was one of Rommel's commanders in North Africa, commanded the Africa Corps before he was wounded. He commanded the 24th Panzer Corps, which was totally surrounded. Now, if it had been on the Western Front, the Germans would have just surrendered, but not in the east. And he was being attacked by 7 Russian armies. An army usually has 3 corps. So he was outnumbered at least 10-1, but he held his position and actually moved that pocket all the way across East Prussia and escaped, got back to German lines. I thought that was the most amazing tactical maneuver in World War II.
Well, definitely, readers, and, that's one thing you want to catch up on. Make a note.
Yeah. And when he got to German lines, there were more civilians inside the pocket than soldiers on the outside, on the edge of it. He had more civilians than soldiers when he finally got there. Brilliant trick. I've always thought Nering was the best tank commander in World War II, including Rommel and Patton. Just a personal view. Another surprising thing, sometimes as a historian you get lucky, and I got a hold of a copy of Hitler's doctor's medical journal, the case file of Adolf Hitler. And it had a lot of drugs listed, actually an incredible amount of drugs, but I didn't know what they were. And I took it to a cousin of mine who's a medical doctor. He'd been a practicing physician for 40 years. And he said, Sandy, I don't know what these drugs are. Many of them haven't been manufactured since the 40s or 1950s. But I had a fishing buddy whose daughter was owner of a medical corporation. She did heart transplants herself and had doctors working under her. And she'd do anything for her daddy. And he asked her to research these drugs, and she had members of her staff do it. And it would have cost me $100,000 if I had to do it, pay for it myself. I couldn't have done it. But I got it for free. And the conclusions were Hitler had a vitamin toxicity. Many of these drugs were vitamins, and he was overdosing himself on vitamins. They estimated he wouldn't have lived but a year or two, if he hadn't committed suicide with the Russians 300 yards away. He also was addicted to amphetamines or speed. And the active, and this is what blew me away, the active ingredient in his eye drops was cocaine. He took up to 19 applications of eye drops per day, 3 or 4 drops in each eye. So I think this partially explains some of his irrational behavior.
I would say it does. He was hooked on cocaine, maybe not knowing it.
Yeah, of course, I'm not sure that anybody back then knew what cocaine was, but they knew, Hitler knew he liked it, I think. And I think that partially explains his irrational behavior sometimes. He was ordering attacks by armies that didn't exist. One day he'd be at the height of euphoria, we're going to win the war. The next day, up the depths of depression, sometimes in the same conversation. General Welding commanded the 56th Panzer Corps. He came to Führer headquarters, and the first words out of Hitler's mouth was, "Welding, I'm going to have you shot." And by the end of the interview, Hitler was quite friendly to Welding and named him Commandant of Berlin. And after Welding left the room, he turned to another general and said, "I would rather he had had me shot." He was captured in Berlin and died in a Russian prison camp 9 years later.
We'll return to our interview with author Sam Mitchum right after these sponsor messages. Hi, everyone. I know you've been hearing me talk about how much I enjoy BritBox. It's the streaming home of the best British TV, with exclusive mysteries, crime dramas, documentaries, and more. I especially enjoy mysteries like Agatha Christie's Poirot and Father Brown. I just enjoyed his story, The Thief, His Wife, and the Canoe. Great story. My daughter has always been a huge Cary Grant fan, and BritBox has a new original called Archie, which stars Jason Isaacs as Archie Leach, the man who became Cary Grant. This is the first time that his story has been told in collaboration with Grant's daughter Jennifer Grant and his ex-wife Diane Cannon. Story and cast all from BritBox, and it's top-notch entertainment, and only on BritBox. Sign up for BritBox today to stream Archie and other fan favorites from any device. I have a special limited-time offer for my U.S. and Canadian fans. Get 50% off your first month when you sign up for a monthly plan, but only if you go to BritBox.com and use my promo code 1001STORIES at checkout. That's 1001STORIES at checkout. Don't wait. Get 50% off your first month. Use promo code 1001STORIES at BritBox.com. You'll be glad you did.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And now, back to our interview. Why was the Soviet siege of Budapest called the Stalingrad of the Waffen-SS? What happened there?
They put in some of their best units, the 8th, 22nd SS Cavalry Divisions. They also put in some non-divisional units. They put in an entire SS Corps, as well as the Army's 13th Panzer Division and Friedenhall, 60th Panzer Division, and they fought house to house and hand to hand. These boys put up a tremendous resistance. Started out with 33,000 men. They finally tried to break out at the very end, and there were 800 of them left. They inflicted a lot of casualties on the Russians, but after that, the southern part of the Eastern Front fell apart quickly, and they managed to take Vienna with little loss. They made their stand at Budapest, and once again, Hitler, just like he did at Stalingrad, refused to allow a timely breakout, because they could have, and they could have done it at Stalingrad. It would have been costly, but you'd have saved the army, and the SS Panzer Corps there would have gotten out, too. German SS morale was pretty much broken at Budapest, and was certainly broken at Vienna, because Hitler stripped some of the top SS panzer divisions of their honor, told them they could not wear the Adolf Hitler cuff band because they were cowards. And whatever you say about the SS, they were not cowards. They would fight you. And that's when Sepp Dietrich, who was former chauffeur and bodyguard to Adolf Hitler, had his officers put all the medals in a chamber pot. And he sent them to Hitler with a cuff band from the 17th SS Panzer Grenadier Division, the Goetz Division. And in Wegener's opera there, Goetz said to the bishop, "Kiss my ass." And that was the message Dietrich was sending to Hitler. I don't think Hitler ever got that. He would have understood it had he received the chamber pot, but I think somebody at Führer headquarters did not pass that message along to the Führer, which is probably a good thing.
Probably a good thing. Yeah, that's one of those missing things, the chamber pot full of medals. I know people would love to know where that is. I have a question for you. It has nothing to do at all with this. Well, it does in a way. Any idea where the skull rings are? When they all turned in their skull rings, I heard they were, the rumor is that they were buried in a mountain. Do you know anything about that one?
Just the rumors.
Yep.
There are all kinds of rumors, as you know. Hitler lived, Bigfoot's been kidnapped by outer space monsters and things like this.
So yep.
You can hear it.
Well, I'll ask you an easier question, Sandy. What kind of fishing do you do and where do you do it?
Oh, I haven't been fishing in a long time, but Louisiana's full of bayous. I usually fish for white perch.
Yes, sir.
Delicious fish. And catfish is good if it's not a bottom feeder. Last time I had catfish, it was, they call them mud cats. They, if they feed in the bottom, the meat tastes like mud.
Yes. Yep.
If you get that at a restaurant, send it back. You won't like it.
Yeah,
I
the last Louisianan I met said, we were talking about the weather. The weather where I live here in Virginia Beach, Virginia. It's not perfect, but at least we're not getting snow right now. I'm real happy about that, but most of the Northeast is. But he said Louisiana is wetter than a dog's mouth.
Oh, it definitely is. And I'll tell you something about Louisianians. In a hurricane, they're like the 300 Spartans. In icy weather, snow, they're like the Cowardly Lion,
yeah.
The Wizard of Oz.
It's the same thing here around Norfolk, Virginia. Yep.
Yeah. They said we might get snow Monday. And I got a call from, I had a doctor's appointment Monday, a routine checkup. They put it off till Friday because of the snow. It ain't snowed. Probably won't. But they're already heading for the hills. The doctor's canceling his appointments.
They don't get too many snow days, so I imagine everybody who could was taking that day off. So,
A good excuse.
Yeah, the Little Rock Democrat had a cartoon. I still got it somewhere. It's kind of funny. It's a picture of a mob of people in panic, hiding the children, danger, and there's one snowflake coming down.
Yep.
And that's about right.
I
do want to mention that was that naval evacuation. East Prussia had 3 million people. And between East Prussia and Pomerania, the German Navy evacuated 2,022,000 people. And a result of terror, the Russians were strafing the refugee columns, ran over a couple of them with their tanks. But it created some of the greatest naval disasters in history, including the greatest naval disaster, the Wilhelm Gustloff. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It was a cruise liner, Ship Through Joy, a Strength Through Joy cruise liner. It was rated for 1,800 people.
Wasn't that transporting refugees out or not? Yeah.
They put 10,580 people on it, and the temperature was 0 degrees Fahrenheit. And they had ice floes in the Baltic Sea. 25 miles offshore, the Russians torpedoed the ship. And it went down 45 minutes. And only 1,259 people survived.
Out of 10,000 plus, right?
Yeah. So over 8,000 people died. That's five times the number killed on the Titanic.
Yeah. It's rumored the Amber Room was in the hold of that ship. There's a rumor out there. We did a story on the Amber Room, the Russian Amber Room, and it was disassembled. And they say that it had been tracked by rail to the port where that ship went out, and that there were witnesses who saw them taking those crates up onto the ship, and that it was in the hold of that ship. That's just a rumor, but you know how those work.
I've never heard that. That ship was crammed to the gills with people. That was the big thing with it. I don't see where they would have had much room for cargo.
Your book does a good job on covering the loss of the air war, 1943 and 44. Other than Hitler deciding to go after Russia, losing his air force was probably, I'm going to guess, his losing the Luftwaffe was probably a deciding factor, if not the deciding factor, in their losing the war. Would you agree on that?
Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. The German Luftwaffe was not properly constructed anyway. It was basically flying artillery for the Army. It never did have a strategic bomber like our B-17. And once they lost the Battle of Britain and committed the Luftwaffe to the Eastern Front, it steadily went downhill. They also lost their fuel. And the thing about it, you got to train those pilots. In 1945, the average German pilot had about 50 hours flight training before he went into combat. The average RAF fighter pilot had 400, and the average American had 450. So we had much better trained pilots. The Germans did have what they call their old eagles, and these guys shot down tons of airplanes. But they'd also been fighting for 5 years. Fatigue had set in. I mean, at the end, the Germans had a joke. We were blowing away their city so badly. The joke was the American Air Force, if it continues bombing German cities, is going to have to start bringing its own targets because there's anything left to hit. There's a lot of truth. By February 45, we were just rearranging rubble in many cases.
Do you have a favorite short story from the book that you'd like to share?
It was a girl I knew. She was a woman then. She was a little girl in East Prussia. Her daddy had been killed on the Eastern Front, And her mom wanted to get out of there before the Russians got in there because they were raping every girl from 8 to 80. And problem is she had no shoes. I mean, you and I, if our shoes are worn out, we can make them last another year if we have to. But it doesn't work that way with kids because their feet grow so darn fast. Well, she had to get her out of there without shoes, so she took her feet and stuck them in cow patties, cow manure, and let them solidify and did it again and again and again. And my friend had cow patty shoes, and she walked all the way across East Prussia, the Danzig Corridor, Pomerania, and half of Brandenburg in these cow patty shoes.
Wow.
And had no health repercussions whatsoever. They reached British lines. She later married an American soldier and was retired up at Fayetteville, North Carolina, last I saw of her. But I thought that was pretty innovative.
That's an amazing story. But so many incredible stories come out of World War II.
Yeah, there really are some good ones. Mm. There was another one. I didn't put it in the book, but I thought you might enjoy it. There was this woman who noticed there was no clothes for anybody. Everything went to the army, and the Germans ran out of textiles. Their bandages were even made out of paper toward the end. But she wanted a new dress. Well, there's no way to get any material for a new dress, but she noticed there was always enough material for Nazi Party flags. So she went to the Gauleiter and said, I would like a party flag to decorate my home. Oh, yes, ma'am. They gave her one. Went to the Kreisleiter. I need a party flag to decorate my home. Oh, yes, ma'am. Here's another one. She went to the Burgermeister. She went to the Wehrkreis office. She went to about 6 different agencies. Every one of them gave her a big flag. And she actually put one of them out in front of her home. She took the other 5, cut them up, and made herself a really nice red dress. And she was the only one in her town who had a new dress. And, of course, everybody asked her, where'd you get the dress from? Well, she told them the truth. They'd have shot her. But what she said was, I ordered this material before the war, and I didn't like it. And I put it in a chest and put it in my attic and forgot about it. So I was cleaning out my attic the other day, and I came across it. I said, well, this really doesn't look too bad. So that's where I got the material for my dress. Pretty innovative. But, they knew how to beat the system, just like some people in our country do. Pretty good humor about it all. Of course, as you know, Germans love beer. And they had a joke about the guy who decided, they had watered down the beer and changed the ingredients. So he poured some of it in the test tube, sent it to the university, their equivalent of the Agricultural Extension Service. About 3 weeks later, he got a report back, and it says, your horse has diabetes.
Yep.
There were a lot of humor around, but I guess it was gallows humor in a way, because they knew that things were falling apart. One of the jokes was, enjoy the war because the peace is going to be horrible.
The split up after the war, when Russia was allowed to pretty much occupy Poland and a good part of the east there, was a terrible time for those countries. And a lot of people felt that that Roosevelt made a mistake by giving away way too much to the Soviet Union. What do you think about that?
Well, he did. I'm not sure he had any choice by that time. They waited till almost the end of the war to make the final agreement. Had he made the agreement, say, in 1942, when the issue was in doubt, he could have gotten a better deal. Waiting till the end of 44 was too late. Matter of fact, 42, Hitler, Stalin would have done pretty much whatever we wanted to make an agreement. He made a public statement that American troops were welcome anywhere on the Eastern Front they cared to serve. He didn't like our tanks, but they loved our trucks. Matter of fact, for many years after the war, into the 1950s, the word Studebaker was a synonym for truck in Russia. They had so many, millions. They had the best trucks that money could, that Detroit could manufacture. Now, they didn't care for our tanks. The Sherman was inferior to certainly the Panther, and I would say the Tiger as well. I think the Panzer Mark IV, the Panther tank, was the Germans considered that their best tank. The Tiger was a fine tank, except it tended to break down. It wasn't mechanically as reliable as the Panther, and it had the turret had an extremely slow turn ratio. It took forever to get the big gun around, and when you got it around, it created a mess. But five or six Shermans could take it on and beat it to death. The Panther was better, according to the Panzertruppen I talked to.
You've written a lot of books on World War II, and you are considered an expert on World War II Germany. At the end of the war, as current thinking goes, Russia and the United States and Great Britain split up somehow Russia's catch of secret weapons. What do you know about what happened there and who got what and how that led to future technology, warfare technology that was used after World War II?
Schweinemug was one of their major bases. It was in the east. The Russians got it. The Russians were astonished. We took one of their major, the Germans' V weapons depositories and laboratories, and it was in the Soviet zone, but it was the end of the war. The Americans had captured this sector, and we simply pulled out. And they got the weapons, and they were astonished that we had not destroyed them.
What was the name of that base or research facility?
Schweinmund. It's now part of Poland. And the V weapons. I forgot the name of the V weapons depository. It was a cave. It wasn't really a settlement. But Schwer, the Minister of Munitions, was really good at putting caves to use. They made natural anti-aircraft bunkers because you could take a hit and from a B-17 and not crash like a building would. And they had caves full of these things, V-1, V-2. They work in a V-3. And we just left them for the Russians. We were a little naive, just honestly. We gave up more than we needed to. Our leadership did.
We did a two-part story here at 1001 Heroes on the Jetlof Pass. I don't know if you ever heard of that. On what was called the Jetlof Pass, it was a story of Russia. This was late 50s. And a group of, I believe it was about 12 college students, long country skiers, a club, went out into the Urals. And they were all found dead months later. They had some leadership and skilled people. They weren't neophytes to being out in the snow in the winter. But they were found violently killed. They were able to recover their cameras and some of the film, and could never figure out, based on the bodily injuries, exactly what happened to them. So it's still under trial today in Russia. Only thing is that Russia won't allow any mention of the Russian military or their experiments in these trials that are going on now. And if you research it and look into it, it looks like these college kids ran into weapons testing of some sort that was used against them. Their weapons
Not
testing.
Not that one in particular. I do know when West Germany absorbed East Germany, they found out that East Germany was a toxic dump. They didn't take precautions with weapons or any environmental considerations whatsoever. And repairing East Germany environmentally was tremendously expensive for West Germany. It's one of the reasons there was some problems with them getting back together, because the differences caused by the Russian occupation. They had to clean up this mess. It cost billions of dollars. And I think, legitimized the discrimination. I mean, the first thing that happened when the wall fell down is about what you would expect. The West German bachelors in their Mercedes drove into East Germany and began picking up East German girls, some of whom had never ridden in a car. And that was funny. But then later they started discriminating against them in employment. In America, it would result in major lawsuits, but East Germans would apply for jobs, and they would offer them about one quarter of the salary of somebody from West Germany. And East Germans would ask them about it, and they'd say, well, you're an East German, you're used to less. And they didn't even have to ask them where they were from. They could look at their clothes and tell they were East, because they kind of looked like Midwestern flood victims. The two sides, and I could see the East German point of view. If you're an East German, you've got a job. It doesn't pay much, but it's yours. You got a little apartment. It's not much, but it's yours. And the wall falls, and here comes a West German in a Mercedes, and he looks at your building and said, yeah, that was my great-grandfather's when the Soviets came. It's mine now. You got 30 days to get out and or pay an exorbitant rent by East German standards. And, I could see where there'd be some friction. And this was not a smooth transition. It could have been worse, but it could have been better. There was a lot of resentment because of the bombings. I remember I ran into a tour guide back in Cologne many, many years ago, and he was talking about the cathedral there and how God protected the cathedral, and because everything else was blown away and there was this field of rubble, but the cathedral was not hit. Well, God may have had something to do with that, but not in the manner he thought, because the U.S. Army made the cathedral the turning point. You want to bomb Cologne, you go fly over the cathedral, turn 160 degrees, fly for four seconds, and you're over your target. It was a turning marker, and you don't attack your turning marker. And that's why the cathedral at Cologne survived. But there were all kinds of stories. The firebombing of Dresden, for example, was pretty horrible. There were more than twice as many people killed in that one raid on Dresden as were killed in the entire Battle of Britain. There were refugees there. It was at least 100,000 people died, but probably more like 125,000. And you could see the fireball 200 miles away. The asphalt on the street caught on fire. Asphalt burns at 750 degrees Fahrenheit. So it was worse than one of the atomic attacks on Japan.
If the assassination attempt on Hitler had been successful, do you believe the war would have continued?
It's a pretty good hypothetical question. I think it would have. It was July. The D-Day invasion had already succeeded. Russia by then didn't have to negotiate. Most people don't realize it, but in 1943, shortly after the Battle of Stalingrad, they had secret Soviet Nazi negotiations. Stalin was willing to make peace, but his condition was Germany had to give up all the territory it had occupied, and Hitler wouldn't buy it. By 44, it was pretty obvious after D-Day that it wasn't going to end well for Nazi Germany. I think there would have been a negotiated peace with the conspirators' government, General Beck, but a lot of people would have lived who in fact perished later. But I don't see much difference in the result in terms of territorial expansion. I think Stalin would have got what he wanted.
What was it that Dietrich once said about his Panzer VI?
Dietrich? Oh, yeah. He was talking about it. Dietrich commanded the 6th Panzer Army, later the 6th SS Panzer Army. And Dietrich had a good sense of humor. He said that they call us Panzer Army VI. German pronunciation of it, because we only have 6 Panzers left. Dietrich was, for a Nazi, a very interesting fellow. Even at the end of the war, when a German soldier deserted, it actually took time before he would sign an execution order. At this point in the war, the army generals were just, if somebody deserted, confirm the sentence and execute them. But Dietrich would meet with a person. He met with this kid. His father had died when he was a child. He was spoiled by his mother. He lived with his mother and his aunts. He lived in a feminine environment. And he was about 15, 16 years old, got drafted to the German army and sent to a panzer unit. And they were mean to him. At least he felt they were. They'd be veterans, sometimes are tough on the newbies. And he deserted. Well, he got caught. And they brought him into Zepp Dietrich, and he told his tale of misery. And Dietrich got up and gave him an ear boxing. German officers were allowed to do that. They're pretty tough because they're designed to break an eardrum. They really hit you. And he did. He hit him in the head, gave him nullified the death sentence, gave him a 30-day leave, said, go home, and when you come back, you'd be ready to be a soldier. Get yourself together emotionally and come back and serve us correctly. And he did, and this guy became a decent soldier. And later, those big Germans, drinks a lot of beer and goes bowling and that sort of thing. But you couldn't say anything bad about Zepp Dietrich in front of him. And I don't blame him. Dietrich was sort of an enigma. You never knew what you were going to get with Zepp Dietrich.
Sam Mitchum, Jr., thank you so much for this book and for all of you've done to bring history to a lot of people. Find your book?
Oh, they can find it at Regnery History, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. Any bookstore would either have it or be able to order it for you. But a lot of people get it stuff from Amazon these days.
And for all you listeners, the book is The Death of Hitler's War Machine by Sam W. Mitchum, Jr. Sam, thanks for being with us here at 1001 Heroes. We appreciate it very much, and we hope to talk to you next book out.
I've got another one coming out.
Can you tell us what you're working on?
Deal on the Confederate generals.
Ah, very good. Very good. Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure having the chance to talk to you. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.